Chapter 8. Things Fall Apart. Amusia and Disharmonia. We take our senses for granted. We feel we are given the visual world, for example, complete with depth, colour, movement, form and meaning, all perfectly matched and synchronous. Given this seeming unity, it may not occur to us that there are many different elements composing a single visual scene, and that all of these have to be separately analysed and then put together. This composite nature of visual perception may be more apparent to an artist or a photographer, or it may become apparent when, due to some damage or failure of development, one element or another is defective or lost. The perception of colour has its own neural basis, and so, too, have the perception of depth, motion, form, and so on. But even if all of these preliminary perceptions are working, there may be difficulty synthesizing them into a visual scene or object with meaning. Someone with such a higher-order defect here, a visual agnosia, for example, may be able to copy a picture or paint a scene so that others can recognize it, but they themselves cannot. It is similar with hearing and with the special complexities of music. There are many elements involved, all concerned with the perception, decoding and synthesis of sound and time, and thus there are many forms of amusia. A.L. Benton, in his chapter on the amusias in Critchley and Henson's Music and the Brain, distinguishes receptive from interpretive or performance amusia and identifies more than a dozen varieties. There are forms of rhythm deafness, slight or profound, congenital or acquired. Che Guevara was famously rhythm deaf. He might be seen dancing a mambo while the orchestra was playing a tango. He also had considerable tone deafness. But, especially after a left hemisphere stroke, one can develop profound forms of rhythm deafness without tone deafness, just as, after some right hemisphere strokes, a patient may develop tone deafness without rhythm deafness. In general, though, forms of rhythm deafness are rarely total, because rhythm is represented widely in the brain. There are also cultural forms of rhythm deafness. Thus, as Erin Hannon and Sandra Trehub have reported, infants at 6 months can readily detect all rhythmic variations, but by 12 months their range has narrowed, albeit sharpened. They can now more easily detect the types of rhythms to which they have previously been exposed. They learn and internalize a set of rhythms for their culture. Adults find it harder still to perceive foreign rhythmic distinctions. Having been raised on Western classical music, I have no difficulty with its relatively simple rhythms and time signatures, but I get confused by the more complex rhythms of tangos or mambos, to say nothing of the syncopations and polyrhythms of jazz or African music. Culture and exposure determine some of one's tonal sensitivities as well. Thus, someone like myself may find the diatonic scale more natural and more orienting than the 22-note scales of Hindu music. But there does not seem to be any innate neurological preference for particular types of music, any more than there are for particular languages. The only indispensable elements of music are discrete tones and rhythmic organization. Many of us are unable to sing or whistle in tune, though usually we are very conscious of this. We do not have an amusia. But true tone deafness is present in perhaps 5% of the population, and people with such an amusia can veer off key without realizing it, or be unable to recognize off-key singing by others. Sometimes tone deafness can be quite gross. I used to attend a small temple that employed a cantor who could hit jarringly wrong notes, sometimes a third of an octave away from where he should have been. He particularly fancied himself a cantillator and would embark on elaborate tonal excursions of a sort that require a very good ear, but he would get completely lost in these. When I complained discreetly to the rabbi one day about the cantor's singing, I was told that he was a man of exemplary piety and that he did his best. I said I had no doubt of this, but that one could not have a tone-deaf cantor. This was, to anyone musical, akin to having a clumsy surgeon. Florence Foster Jenkins, a coloratura who attracted a sell-out audience to Carnegie Hall in her time, considered herself a great singer and attempted the most difficult operatic arias, arias that required a flawless ear as well as an extraordinary vocal range. But she would sing notes that were excruciatingly wrong, flat, even screechy, without, apparently, realizing that she was doing so. Her sense of rhythm was also terrible, but audiences continued to flock to her concerts, which always featured great theatrics and many costume changes. Whether her fans were devoted to her in spite of her lack of musicality or because of it is not clear.